warm, a high of 79. The numbers right now, humidity still high at 85%. A little breeze from the southwest at 5. 72 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha. 68 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It was exactly 2 months ago, on the 28th of June, that we learned the shocking news of the sudden and unexpected death of Racine County Executive Jonathan Delagrave at the age of 51. I was out of town at the time, out of state, in fact, and did not return to the station until early July, and it just wasn't practical to try to put together some sort of response here on the morning show to Mr. Delagrave's death. But we're doing so today by going into the archives and replaying for you two different interviews that I recorded with him. First, just a quick word about Mr. Delagrave's long and distinguished career in public service. A Racine native, a Case High School graduate, Mr. Delagrave earned his bachelor's degree from the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse and a master's degree from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I believe his first public office was as chair of the town of Caledonia, and he was chair when the town of Caledonia became the village of Caledonia. In 2003, he began working for Racine County as part of the Department of Human Services and actually became Director of Human Services in 2010. He was elected Racine County Executive in 2015 and re-elected twice in 2019 and 2023. As I read the articles that were written in the immediate wake of his death, I was struck by the heartfelt and sincere expressions of sympathy and sorrow that came from both sides of the political aisle. There were many, many people who deeply admired and appreciated Jonathan Delagrave and his devotion to the people of Racine County. I have two interviews in the Morning Show archives that are available for replay. The first of them actually dates back to before he was county executive, when he was director of Racine County Human Services. As I listened again to this interview for the first time since it originally aired, I was struck by Mr. Delagrave's passion and intelligence and practical nature. And I think all of those things come through in this interview. So from sometime between 2010 and 2015, here is an interview with Jonathan Delagrave, at that point director of Racine County Human Services.
We're going to be speaking for the next few minutes here of WGTD's morning show with Jonathan Delagrave, who is director of Racine County Human Services. We appreciate him making time in his very busy schedule to talk about a very important matter, which has been getting a lot of attention lately. We are going to be talking about some of the efforts that are underway to detect and curb certain abuses of aid and subsidies, which are designed to make life better for all of us, in particular for people who find themselves in less than ideal circumstances. But there is, of course, the unhappy reality of people finding ways around it, finding loopholes, or just doing outright illegal things to maybe access more aid than is rightfully theirs, or maybe accessing aid they have absolutely no right to whatsoever. I mean, there are a number of different ways, probably a limitless number of ways in which there can be wrongdoing and fraud. It's an unfortunate reality, and Jonathan Delagrave knows this full well and firsthand in many respects. And we're going to talk with him for the next few minutes about some concerns which have arisen over the food share program, and also of subsidies of current daycare centers, and what is underway right now to try to, in a sense, maybe clean up the system or make sure that the people that most need help are receiving it. And Jonathan Delagrave, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Have I stated kind of the state of affairs fairly accurately just now?
Yeah, I mean, it's an issue. It is. You know, I think I should open up by saying that, you know, the vast majority who do receive the benefits of these programs are honest and hardworking. It's those people who are defrauding the system are really making it bad and quite frankly are taking away the resources from people who really need them. So from that standpoint, you know, I do want to make that clear. But that being said, there's no question that fraud is a problem. Racine County has in the past year or so has really taken an aggressive stance. We have implemented a fraud task force with Human Services, the Sheriff's Department, and the District Attorney. We are now partnering with the United States Department of Agriculture on the Food Share, which is, you know, the entity that runs the federally funded program. So we're trying to combine our resources to attack and limit fraud as much as possible. However, the fraud task force and our fraud officer are funded locally, not through the state. So we're implementing a federal and state program, and we have to fight fraud essentially with local tax dollars, which, you know, at times can be a little frustrating, especially with resources so limited.
Right. On the other hand, I should think that this is something that a lot of people care about. And I'm just guessing that there's a fairly healthy swath of the public who sees this as a very worthwhile endeavor.
Oh, absolutely. And we're finding as a Human Services Department, you know, that we hear, whether it be public hearings or on our fraud hotline, which is always fairly busy. By the way, anybody who does see fraud can call that fraud hotline. So we hear that, and, you know, we hear that quite often, and it is important not only from a taxpayer standpoint, but just as importantly, making sure that those individuals who actually need it are getting it as well.
Explain to us, first of all, how the Food Share program works. how it's supposed to work.
Sure. What happens is the federal government in the 1960s created a food share program, which was to temporarily help needy families with assistance in helping them obtaining food for their family. The program has grown exponentially over the years, and in fact, in 2003, it was about $244 million to Wisconsin. That has grown up to almost $800 million in the last year. So you're looking at a program that has really taken off quite a bit in the last 4 or 5 years. And that also has to do with the stimulus program as well. So what happens is a family will come to our department and apply, and they will get food share based on their income that they receive. They get it on a monthly stipend, and it's put on a Quest card. It's similar to a credit card, and they can use that credit card at grocery stores to buy their food.
So tell us the most common way in which fraud is being perpetrated in the food share program.
Well, there's a number of ways. There could be the individual who owns a gas station who obtained a Quest card obtained a Quest card for cash. So essentially, The Quest card had $300. The person came in, they said they gave $100 in cash to that person. They traded their card over. That individual goes to a grocery store and buys Gatorade in bulk for their gas station with a Quest card. Or you could have the recipient exchange their Quest card for cash for drugs or clothing or whatnot that they deem what they want to spend on.
So you have people selling their food share cards.
That would be the biggest one, correct. You have individuals losing their Quest card, and then they come for a replacement. And essentially, now that they have multiple Quest cards, and although we can at times, stop that, it doesn't always happen right away. Or we'll have somebody use their Quest card and buy, for example, baby formula in bulk, and that baby formula can be used to make drugs and whatnot. So there's quite a bit of ways that an individual can defraud the system. Also, if you go to our county jail, you would think that the food share would not would stop, but essentially the rules are in place that the food share, they would still continue to get food on their card while they're in the county jail, and we're trying to change that. So I guess that's not fraudulent, but I certainly do think it's ethical, an ethical issue at least.
Right. So typically, how are you and those in your office able to detect fraud?
Sure.
Any of these kinds of fraud with food share,
yes.
when fraud occurs, how typically does that come to your attention, or do you manage to detect it by your own efforts?
Well, we detect it. We have a fraud officer. He's a retired police officer and does a great job. So what he does is he'll either hear from our fraud hotline and investigate, or most of the time, one type of fraud leads to another, and it kind of opens up a can of worms. So we are proactively investigating fraud as much as we possibly can in Racine County. We're working with the Sheriff's Department. So, for example, we might hear from somebody on our fraud hotline that so-and-so is trading their Quest card, their food card. Well, our fraud officer will go out and investigate, and then typically that will lead to him finding out about more fraud in maybe not even in food share, but child care or other types of programs. So that's one way of investigating. Another way of investigating it is that we will the grocery stores will call us and say, hey, you know, this person comes in at 3 o'clock every other day to buy X, Y, and Z with somebody else's Quest card. We know that that's not that person, so then we'll send our fraud investigator over, investigate, turn that over to the Sheriff's Department, which in turn will potentially issue an arrest or something similar to that, and then that will be forwarded to the DA's office. So we're proactively, as best we can, trying to tackle fraud with the limited resources we have.
Right. It seems like there's two ways to go about this. I mean, more than that, actually, but looking at it simplistically, you can go after people that are perpetrating fraud, but there's also perhaps ways in which the system itself could be changed.
Oh, absolutely.
So that fraud would be more difficult to perpetrate. What are your thoughts along that line, and are there specific efforts underway?
Well, the state of Wisconsin and Senator John Lehman appointed me to a legislative council committee that is studying program integrity and fraud. And I sit on that committee. It meets once a month with legislators and other key members from all over the state of Wisconsin trying to look at, you know, potentially changing rules or maybe asking for waivers from the federal government to tighten it down. So I don't know did you need examples of that? What?
Maybe just one or two.
Sure. For instance, if you go, I mentioned it before, but if you get $500 a month and you don't spend that $500 a month, or whether you spend it or not, the next month you get another $500 in food share. So you can accumulate that money. If you're going to jail, you can't spend that money, so why should it accrue? So potentially if you're in jail for, you know, 6 months and you get out, well, your Quest card has a significant amount of money on it. So that's one way we would like to curb it. Another way is, you know, we want to, as Human Services, if there's a family of four, Greg, and there's two kids in that family, and we know that that Quest card hasn't been used for a couple of months, we would say, hey, potentially those kids are not eating. Let's turn that over to our Child Protective Services Division and investigate, because potentially there could be some issues there with the children in that family. Right now, we can't are not allowed to do that. Hmm. So those are a couple of things that I would like to see change right off the cuff.
We're speaking with Jonathan Delagrave. He is director of Racine County Human Services, and we're spending a few minutes on today's morning show talking about the issue of fraud in regards to a couple of very important programs. Another program in which some headlines have been made, and a lot of people are very disturbed at some fraud that's been perpetrated when it comes to subsidies of daycare services, and of certain persons manipulating the system and or fabricating child care scenarios or child care services rendered, which in fact have not been rendered, and then receiving subsidy monies that they in no way deserve. Tell us how this first came to the attention of your office.
Well, it came in the fact that there was a case that, again, we found out through the public, and essentially what happened was that you had three sisters who applied to the child care issue, and essentially each sister was taking care of each other's kids. And technically, that's ethically, in my mind, not right. They were receiving a subsidy for that, and that was kind of the first ball that got rolling on the child care issue.
So tell us the means by which this kind of fraud can be detected, because it seems like this is quite a tricky matter, in which I mean, just the limited understanding I have, I'm not sure I see where the paper trail or electronic trail really is, where one could see the evidence of the wrongdoing in a tangible way.
Well, it's a little bit more difficult than food share. You're correct on that, Greg. You know, we do site visits, and we do and we come, we do those somewhat unannounced, and we hope that if there are issues going on, that we find them on those site visits. We are in constant contact with the staff at the child care centers, and in making sure that they're complying with the rules that are mandated by the state. So just proactively getting out there and being in contact with the child care facilities itself is a big way that we can kind of see what's going on.
Any idea of how rampant this particular kind of fraud is? And if you have some idea, how do you have some idea? Or is it really hard to estimate?
You know, I want to be careful on how I approach this, because when I opened up the interview, I do want to say that, like food share, the same with child care, there are many facilities that are great and are complying with the rules set forth, and they are in the majority. But unfortunately, you know, there are people who take advantage of the system. It's pretty wide. It's pretty rampant. I would say that you see, some of the same people who are committing fraud at one facility are closing down and potentially opening up another child care facility with a different name, and maybe their name's not on the license itself, but they're associated with it and know how to beat the system. So I would say that, you know, it's definitely a concern, and we're definitely monitoring the best we can. Our fraud officer is definitely monitoring. You know, I would hate to put a number on it other than the fact that, you know, we have a number of cases that we're monitoring, and there are a number of cases that we have taken to the Sheriff's Department and the District Attorney's Office and have closed the facility. So, and I don't see that trend is going to stop anytime soon.
Right. I think one of the things that it seems like this particular kind of fraud we're talking about right now would be especially tempting in that it would be so easy to enter into it incrementally. That is, to operate a perfectly fine facility, law-abiding and getting the subsidies that they fully deserve, but then to just sort of tweak the books a little bit to maybe add a name or two that aren't really a part of it. I mean,
yeah.
It just seems like you could so easily sort of sneak into to perpetrating fraud, even on a very limited scale, and which in and of itself, of course, is cause for concern. But that then gets so easily kind of get away from that. You're successful once, maybe twice, and again. I wonder if that pattern sounds familiar.
Well, exactly, and that's exactly correct. As well as the rules set forth, I think invite, especially with the food share and child care, the rules invite you to, I think, at first ethically defraud the system. So maybe from a legal standpoint, you're not defrauding the system, but ethically you are. And then once you hit that or cross that ethical boundary, then it leads into defrauding the system legally. And I think there's where you start to find that pattern where, you know, they start, well, it says in the rules I can do X, Y, and Z, so I'm going to do it, even though maybe ethically it's not correct. That leads to legally some of the legal issues that or criminal issues that these child care and food share individuals have or lead to.
I want to give you just a quick opportunity to reiterate something which you said briefly, which and I think this is one of the reasons why this whole topic is so important, the fact that we do not want to leave people with the impression that there aren't law-abiding citizens out there receiving this kind of aid. I mean, it would be a mistake to jump to that kind of conclusion, even as we talk about as unhappy a reality as fraud. Not everybody is engaging in fraud.
Well, that's correct. And it's my job as Human Services Director to ensure that the people who need those services are getting those services, and the people who are defrauding the system are going to be found and be held accountable for their actions. I do look at that as a big part of my job. I look at that as a big challenge for our department. And, you know, I think the Racine County and the county executive has made it clear that fraud is not going to be tolerated. It's not going to be ignored. And that we're going to do everything we can in the best of our ability to tackle the fraud issue and ensure that those people who are frauding the system are going to be held accountable.
Jonathan De La Grave is Director of Racine County Human Services. I thank you for joining me today on the morning show to address this important topic.
Thanks for having me, Greg. I really appreciate it.
The preceding morning show interview was initially broadcast sometime between 2010 and 2015. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we're remembering former Racine County Executive Jonathan De La Grave, who unexpectedly passed away exactly 2 months ago today, on June 28th, at the age of just 51. The second interview we're airing today dates from the summer of 2020, not long after Mr. De La Grave had contracted COVID-19. I reached out to Mr. De La Grave to see if he would be willing to talk about this on the air, and he readily and enthusiastically agreed, believing, as I did, that it might be helpful. Here is that conversation with the late Jonathan Delagrave from the summer of 2020.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really pleased that I can spend most of today with Racine County Executive Jonathan Delagrave, who was on the program not too long ago. And we're glad to have him back, in part at least, to talk about his own all-too-personal encounter with COVID-19. But we're going to start our conversation today with his update on what Racine County experienced late Monday afternoon into early Monday evening, with, of course, a ferocious storm that tore through actually Racine, Kenosha, and Walworth counties, and to a large swath of Wisconsin even beyond. But it sure seems like we here in the southeastern corner of the state took a major brunt of this incredible storm. So we're going to start there. First of all, Mr. Delagrave, we welcome you back to the morning show. Thank you for making time for this conversation.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity, Greg. Glad to be here.
So what was the storm like for you, and where did you experience it? I'm just curious where you were late Monday afternoon.
Yeah, so I was at a human services meeting at our human services building, and it was a virtual meeting. I was with two other staff, and we were having the meeting, and you could just, there was a panoramic window that we were looking out, so we can kind of see this whole thing kind of come at us, and it made for interesting viewing for sure. Never seen anything like it, and kind of just saw it all happening. Our internet connection kept going in and out. We were able to get through our meeting, but yeah, it was certainly a sight to see.
So what can you tell us about the kind of damage that was sustained by Racine County, and also some of the specific Racine County official facilities that,
sure,
I understand, well, suffered some damage?
Yeah, as we were talking a little bit before, Greg, you know, a 100-year storm is 4.5 inches of water for over a 24-hour period. So to put it in perspective, we got, you know, parts of Racine County got 5 inches of water or rain in 1 hour. So you can just imagine how intense the storm was. You know, from a standpoint of power outage, we still have 5,000 people who have not gotten power back since 4:30 yesterday, or on Monday, I should say. And then a lot of basement flooding, a lot of damages to our businesses. You know, and then in terms of county, we were kind of in the eye of the storm. Our courthouse got severely damaged, mostly by flooding. Our county board chambers, which is west of the eye, got a lot of flooding. And then one of our parks got a sinkhole and damaged some of the piping or infrastructure. So we did see a lot of damage around the county, not just in particular to county buildings, but just with our residents as well and businesses.
Right. As far as you know, there was nothing in the way of significant injuries from this storm?
Yeah, as far as I know, the positive is that, you know, we don't have, as far as I know at this point, no injuries or nobody, no loss of life.
Right. And I'm sure you are as appreciative as any of us are about the quick work of, for instance, We Energies and others to try to address some of the immediate damage of the storm.
Yeah, we're really grateful. I know some of those, like I said, 5,000 people are probably a little frustrated because they haven't got their power back on. But, you know, most that lost power got their power situation taken care of pretty quickly. So, you know, I do have a lot of empathy for those 5,000 residents, and hopefully today they'll get everything will be turned back on.
Right. And we want to remind our listeners that we are recording this interview actually on Tuesday morning. So it's actually as of Tuesday morning that some 5,000 Racine County residents were still without power. And one certainly hopes by the time this is airing Wednesday morning that everybody is back up and running. That's of course what we want. My wife, parenthetically, works for a flood damage restoration company, and as you can well imagine, their phone is ringing off the wall, and so there are a lot of people that sustained quite a bit of damage from this this incredible storm. So glad to get your summary of what we experienced in Racine County.
Before we get to kind of your own personal story, let's turn to kind of the other storm engulfing us right now, which is this COVID-19. And we're going to be actually talking with a couple of representatives of the Racine County Health Department in the next couple of days on the morning show. But from your perspective, first of all, before we get into your own personal story, how are things looking in terms of how we are dealing with COVID-19?
Well, from a resources standpoint, Racine County is in really good shape. We were able to help our businesses out with personal protection equipment. We've amassed quite a stockpile. We're working hand in hand with our health departments, especially the Central County Health Department, in terms of contact tracing. We have a lot of community-based testing going on. But it's really important that individuals, especially with compromised immune systems, maintain vigilance with protecting themselves and their loved ones. I think it's unfortunately going to be here a while. Hopefully it dissipates, but we all have to maintain a track of staying healthy and doing what's best given everyone's personal situation.
Right. I wonder if you have any comment on the kind of the sticky matter that has arisen here and elsewhere in Wisconsin when it comes to enforcement of the governor's mask mandate and in terms of the role that, for instance, county sheriffs and other law enforcement prudentially could play in the enforcement of that. Quite a few officials, including, I think, in our own area, are taking a little bit of a hands-off approach. Do you have a perspective on that you want to share?
Well, I do, Greg. I mean, I think that, you know, ultimately it's pretty hard for me to ask our sheriff and the hardworking members of the sheriff's office to enforce an ordinance that it's quite cumbersome to do so. And then our district attorney, you know, willing to take on those cases if it's enforced. Capacity is stretched thin. And I really believe that, most people are going to do what's best for themselves and best for their family and friends. And, you know, most people are wearing masks in Racine County, whether there's an ordinance or not. But to put an enforcement on law enforcement and putting another layer on our district attorney's office, it's pretty difficult to do, especially when, like I said, most are wearing a mask. Most believe that wearing a mask is important. And that's kind of where we stand.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Racine County Executive Jonathan Delagrave. We're going to turn now to what really prompted this invitation for Mr. Delagrave to return to the morning show so soon after his previous visit. We again appreciate you making time in your busy schedule for this conversation. As many of our listeners perhaps know from the news release that was sent out, you yourself ended up testing positive for this coronavirus. Tell us, first of all, at the outset, were you experiencing symptoms that prompted you to get tested? Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a really good question, Greg. So what I can remember the day I was in my office on Wednesday. It was a Wednesday, and I had a little bit of a coughing spell. But other than that, I was fine. And then I woke up Thursday, and actually I had taken a planned day off, and I golfed 9 holes. But, you know, through the round, I started to get a headache and feel a little achy. And when I was done, I immediately went and got tested. So I didn't have, severe symptoms, but I definitely was experiencing some symptoms, for sure.
Do I remember that this was back in June at some point?
It was the Thursday when I first started feeling symptoms. It was the Wednesday before Memorial Day weekend.
Oh, okay. So actually, yeah. Late May. That.
Yes.
So tell us where you went to be tested and what that COVID test was like. I think for those of us who have not needed to or had reason to be tested, we're kind of curious about what at least some of these COVID tests are like. Where did you get to be tested?
So as soon as I got off the golf course, I went immediately got tested in the city of Racine at Festival Hall. It opened at 11 and I was there at 10:30. There was a little bit of a line, but got through it quickly. And I was a little nervous about the test because back then, Greg, testing had just started and you kind of heard, well, they're gonna have a swab and they're gonna put it up in your nose and it may hurt. And, you know, so I was a little nervous about that. But the National Guard did the testing. And what I can tell you is the first part is when you're going to let them know who you are, make sure you spell your name loud and clearly, because they misspelled my name and it ultimately cost me 3 days of not knowing. And they spell your name clearly, everybody who's listening.
Even if you're the Racine County executive.
Yes, spell your name clearly, for sure. And so got tested, and then I was expecting to hear back on Monday because it was a Thursday, and then I called, didn't hear anything. Well, first of all, the swab itself, Greg, that went up my nose, it didn't hurt. It actually tickled. It did cause a little bit of tears, watering of the eyes, I should say. But it did not hurt. It, like I said, it more tickled than anything. So got that done, and then really started to feel sick on Friday and Saturday. Didn't think I had COVID, though. At that time, it was just such a small percentage of people that you never think it's going to happen to you, right?
Right. And can you just specify what your symptoms were as you were feeling increasingly sick? What kinds of symptoms were you experiencing?
Yeah, so I had the headache and achiness. You know, I didn't have in a slight temp. Those were my symptoms. And there are so many other symptoms associated with this, but those were my symptoms. That went through the weekend. I called, they said they lost my test. So then I went over to Ascension and they allowed me to get a same day test and result. And then just as I was about to do that, the National Guard had found my test. They had misspelled my last name and they said you were positive and had to quarantine. And then, you know, from there a ripple effect happens because I have kids, my wife has a compromised immune system. She has severe Crohn's disease.
Mm.
Through that process, again, my family got tested and they all tested positive as well. And so really, I think an understated point that happens is when you're in quarantine for 14 days is you're in 14 days pretty much with your family. And those are also can be challenging as well. I'm sure my wife could tell you a lot more about the challenges of living with me constantly for 14 days. And I can tell you about the challenges of living with my kids for 14 days for sure. But, you know, through that 14 days, Greg, I was pretty lucky. Like I said, I had 3 days, maybe four, that I felt awful or under the weather. My kids, again, they were asymptomatic. So, but my wife got pretty sick. Not in a way where we were ever having to think about going to an ER or consulting with a physician, but she felt pretty awful and was pretty much bedridden for 2 weeks.
Wow. Were you told by your doctor to do anything in particular aside from remaining in quarantine? I mean, for instance, were you advised to try to treat your symptoms with over-the-counter medication or anything else to try to weather this period?
So I only really talked to my doctor once, and it was more just to let him know that I had tested positive. It didn't warrant me to really have significant my symptoms didn't warrant me to have significant contact with my physician. But I will say the one thing is, you know, for me, temperatures spiked and then regressed. So my doctor was like, please just take some acetaminophen or Tylenol or Advil when you do have a temperature that spikes. So I had a 103.9
Wow.
temperature for a day, but taking Advil brought that down, and then it would come back up, and then you'd take another Advil. So controlling your temperature with that was really the only thing that my doctor told me. In my wife's case, she was consulting with her physician quite a bit because she had a compromised immune system, and she had to do some other things that.
How did you end up passing the time during quarantine?
Yeah, I mean, that's a real challenge. We had some nice weather that week, so I was out of my backyard quite a bit, wanting to get some fresh air, watching a lot of Netflix and reading. There was no sports on at that time. That's something that's an interest of mine. There was really no shows that they were all reruns, really. So just a lot of streaming and reading. My son and I built 3 replica stadiums, Camp Randall, the Kohl Center, and Miller Park out of Legos. So that took some time as well. But, you know, ultimately that's how we pass time. For me, one thing I'd like to add, Greg, is that we, you know, another residual effect of COVID is you're just laying or sitting down so much. So my back really started to hurt. That was one of the bigger challenges for me, is just your back gets sore because you're just not up and about. So that was a point. And then the last symptom I really had, Greg, is a few days my heart would race at night. This is going to sound a little weird probably to your listeners, but I don't like to hear the sound of my own heartbeat. And I could, at night, it would happen. So navigating that wasn't always the easiest. And that was a symptom, I think, that also that I had as well.
Wow. During this time, were you, in a sense, completely off of work? I mean, were you on sick leave for those 2 weeks, or were you checking in at least from time to time in the office?
No, we had a lot of phone. We were doing a little bit of Zoom at that point. Now we're doing a lot of Zoom. You know, emails, things of that nature. That actually really helped me as well, just waking up, checking my emails. So off in the standpoint of not up and about, but certainly communicating to my staff and them communicating to me of what's going on, making some decisions. So, you know, my job is one where you can be, if you are sick or need to be quarantined, you can still do some of it and still make decisions and attend meetings virtually.
Right. I read in the news release that you have no clear idea or firm idea of where or how you might have contracted COVID. Do you have a couple of theories at least, or is this really a mystery?
I have one theory. So none of my staff who I was around got it. None of my friends who I played golf with the day before I felt symptoms got it. So I think I have a friend who was asymptomatic that I accidentally took a drink of Diet Coke out of his bottle just by mistake. I honestly think that's where I got it, because otherwise I really don't know. It's a mystery.
Right. So you've been yourself pretty careful through all of this. So you, as far as you know, it was not for any kind of lackadaisical attitude that you might have harbored about COVID-19 and how serious a threat this was. It sounds like you've been taking it seriously.
Yeah, we were taking it pretty seriously because of my wife's condition. So we ultimately were pretty vigilant about, you know, taking the necessary steps. I know my kids, we really didn't let them, you know, they weren't going out and seeing friends. They were pretty much homebound. So yeah, we were pretty vigilant, and it still happened.
So once the 2-week quarantine was over, how were you feeling at that point? And were you able to go back to work and hit the ground running, or were there lingering side effects?
I was lucky. I had those first 3-4 days, and then I was pretty asymptomatic after that. You know, 2/3 of my quarantine was pretty much me being symptomatic free. So when I got back to work, you know, I wanted to you know, one of the things that I think is important for people who are recovering from COVID or fully recovered is, you know, there is a little bit of a stigma in terms of, should you be at work? Are you still symptomatic? You know, and I, you know, so a big part of my journey was making sure I was establishing trust, you know, mainly with my coworkers, saying that I was safe. I, you know, and they were pretty, they were great about it as well. But, you know, you want to make sure that when you do go back to work, that it's something that your coworkers or your workers that you work with are trusting you, and also that you're not putting them in a position of being potentially exposed to COVID.
Right. So what is your advice, having experienced COVID, in terms of how seriously you want people to take this, and what kind of precautions do you want to be, do you want people to really encourage follow as we weather this together?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for the opportunity for allowing me to even answer that question, because it's a big part of the reason why I wanted to be on with you today, Greg, is that first and foremost, you want to take the necessary precautions that the CDC are recommending, especially if you have a compromised immune system like my wife. So first and foremost, you know, don't get into large gatherings, wear a mask, you know, try to eliminate yourself from being put in a bad position, even going into elevators, for example. Make sure that you're doing that in a safe way. And then ultimately, if you do get exposed to COVID, it's really rest in following your physician's orders. From my understanding, you know, COVID affects every individual differently. I was lucky, but, you know, some, there are a lot that aren't so lucky. So again, it's really working with your physician. I know that if you do feel symptomatic, you don't want to necessarily go right to an ER. You want to contact your physician and start a game plan that way. So I think that's important as well.
Right. This last question I asked you, is that the reason why you went public in the way that you did, in terms of telling the public that you had experienced COVID in this direct way? Was that the main reason why you wanted this story told?
Yeah, it was. I felt that, you know, talking to my wife, and, you know, do we just keep this within intra-county government, or do we tell the public? And, you know, ultimately we came to the conclusion that, you know, if I can get it, anybody can get it. If I'm taking all the precautions but still getting it, you know, anybody can get it. And we just want to know, we want to let people know that, first, there's no stigma attached to being COVID positive. And second, if you don't have COVID, that's great. Take every step to continue to prevent, because it's a very serious issue.
And by the way, I hope your wife is feeling better now. It sounds like she bore the brunt of this more than you did.
Yeah, she really did. No, she's back at work. She works at in our local hospital here, and she's now back at work in 100%. So I appreciate you asking.
Great, Jonathan Delagrave, Racine County Executive. Thank you again for being part of the morning show today.
It's my honor. Thank you so much.
A conversation with former Racine County Executive Jonathan Delagrave, who unexpectedly passed away exactly 2 months ago today, on June 28th, at the age of 51. He will be missed. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on the morning show, I look forward to a conversation with Dr. John Swallow, the president of Carthage College. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today we will have variable cloudiness and warm temperatures, but not as warm as it's been. Today's high, just 79 degrees.
Overnight, overnight low of 65 degrees. More sunshine tomorrow and a high of 78 degrees. We do show a 50% chance of rain on Friday and a high in the low 80s. Similar sort of forecast as we get into Saturday, Sunday, and by early next week, our daytime highs only in the low 70s. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elk,